Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seeds podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, or in this case, maybe I should say Parisian culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The thing about Chez Panisse is when you work there, it's hard to go somewhere else because people don't have those standards. You know, you go work for somebody and they're like, oh, you know, we can't use that ingredient, it's too expensive. At Chez Panisse with Alice, nothing was too expensive. We were using organic butter. This is 25 years ago when it was $7 a pound.
This week, we're thrilled to have with us the author, pastry chef, and seminal food blogger, David Leibovitz. David founded one of the first food blogs that anyone can remember, davidleibovitz.com, in 1999. And it's now bigger and better than ever. He is also the author of 8 books, including the just released updated and revised for the 10th anniversary of the original publication of The Perfect Scoop, which is widely recognized to be one of the definitive books on ice cream. And because he doesn't have enough to do, he's also recently published La Part. How do they do with pronunciation?
Perfect.
All right. Yeah. A hilarious eye-opening account of his insane adventure renovating his apartment in Paris. Welcome to Special Sauce, David Leibovitz. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Ed. It's really great to be here with you.
Let's jump in right at the beginning. Tell us about life at the Leibovitz family table growing up.
Wow. That's a long time ago. It's funny because people say you get, as you get older, like you start losing your memory. I'm like, no, it's just a lot more stuff to remember.
It's true. You just need a bigger hard drive.
Yeah, exactly. My hard drive's full. Yeah, you know, I was fortunate. My mother was a good cook. You know, when I went to college, I actually found out from people, you know,
that other people had bad.
Yeah, people were like,
my
mother never cooked. I'm like, whoa.
And where was this?
I'm in Connecticut.
Uh huh.
And I do remember my best friend's, when I went to his house, I think I was 8 years old, his mother made chicken coated with cornflakes. And I was like, what is this amazing food? Because my mother never made anything like that. You know, she wasn't fancy at all, but she was just a good cook. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate to have that, you know, in my life.
And were you always curious? Were you one of these kids that gets on top of the chair to watch your mother cooking? Or
no, but when my parents used to leave us alone or with the babysitter, you know, we had TV dinners. It was the era of TV dinners. I loved frozen fried chicken.
Who doesn't? Swanson, Hungry Man, frozen fried chicken.
Well, once I learned that you could just buy the chicken without, like, the mashed potatoes and the mixed vegetables and the little dessert, you peel the thing. I was like, I'm just buying the box of chicken. So I ate that sometimes. But once my mother and father went out and I pulled my mother's settlement cookbook off the shelf, and I was kind of looking at it and going, oh, I want to make a chocolate souffle. Well, of course.
Wait a minute. How old were you?
Well, how old are kids? You know, once again, it's a long time ago.
So maybe 10 or 11?
Yeah. So, you know, I looked at this recipe, and of course we didn't have a souffle dish. We lived in Connecticut. So I used a Pyrex measuring cup. And my mother had, of course, Baker's unsweetened chocolate. She had everything there. You know, souffle is not a challenging thing. And I made one. It was really good.
And it didn't collapse?
No. It was, I mean, soufflés are pretty foolproof in a lot of ways. And then I graduated to good seasoned salad dressing, you know. That's where I got my sort of pastry, you know, measuring everything precisely up to the line. And after good seasoned salad dressing, where do you go from there?
That's funny. So, what was she really good at? Like, what were your favorite meals?
It's hard to say. She made a lot of ribs. She loved ribs.
Baked, not on the grill.
Yeah. We had a grill, but, you know, it was kind of those days in America where people didn't grill so much.
Right.
So she made really good ribs. And I remember she just marinated them in, like, soy sauce. And it was probably some recipe out of Woman's Day or something. But, you know, it was the real deal.
Right.
So they were delicious.
And were you born with a sweet tooth?
No. And it's funny because I was doing a demo recently and I said, well, I don't really like sweets. And everyone started laughing. I'm like, what? And then I realized, like, I like desserts. I don't like things that are heavily sugary.
Right.
So you don't
like chuckles.
I love chuckles. But see, once again, they're not.
That's sugary.
But there's a tanginess to them. They're umami.
Umami of chuckles.
Yeah. There's certain, like, I don't like things with, like, a lot of cream and sugar.
Got it.
You know, pastry cream is, like, too much for me. Right. So I like chocolate, which is bitter. I like coffee. I like fruit, you know, rhubarb, raspberries, and, you know, all those things.
It's funny about pastry chefs and not liking sweets because actually one of the things I was going to ask you about was you managed to betray your enthusiasm for chocolate and croissants even now throughout your books. And I know a lot of pastry chefs, like Nancy Silverton, she stopped eating bread, right? One of the great seminal bread bakers in America, right? Other than Steve Sullivan, maybe, at Acme in Berkeley. And she doesn't eat bread anymore. When I'm reading your books, even Le Par and My Sweet Life in Paris, you still are very enthusiastic about really good caramels or really good...
Also, it's part of life in Paris, and it sounds a little, you know, some people go, oh, you're so lucky. But it's actually how people live in Paris. Like, eating a croissant is not a luxury in France.
Right.
It's part of everyday life. You know, it's kind of like going to Starbucks and, you know, getting a coffee here. It's just you go by the bakery and you get a croissant. It's not considered something chic or luxurious. It's just an everyday thing. And, you know, people always say to me, you know, don't you go to this place, you know, on the other side of town and... you know, get the croissant. They won best croissant of the year. And it's like telling a New Yorker, you know, if you live on like the Lower East Side, oh, don't you go to the Upper West Side and buy coffee from that place that won the best.
Right.
You know, it's like, no, I'm going to my corner coffee
exactly.
place.
Exactly. No, it's true.
So I do like all that stuff. And it excites me. You know, I'm a baker and I love being in Paris and I love seeing the bakeries and chocolate shops. And it's exciting to me. The less fancy as I get older or as I get more mature, I tend to like less fancy, though, like Eric Kaiser, who's now in New York.
Right.
I like his pastries because they're very simple.
Yeah.
They're the kind of things I want to eat. I don't want to eat a thing with like three sorts of cream and caramelized out of season fruit and all that.
His baguette is really delicious. And he's clearly got some serious backing because he's opening Eric Kaiser Bakeries at a feverish pace. Mm-hmm. I think not just in New York, all over America.
Well, when he was a young man, he wrote these really amazing baking books, bread baking books in French, and they were translated in English. It was a series of six really great textbooks on baking for anybody. You know, you don't have to be a professional to understand them. And so he really knows what he's doing. And, you know, in France, you know, oftentimes people go, oh, it's a chain, c'est une chaîne, c'est pas bon. You know, they don't like the fact that something's a chain. But on the other hand, in France, if something's called a boulangerie, the bread has to be made on the premises. So he has, and I'm just taking a guess, you know, 15 bakeries in Paris. All the breads are made in those bakeries.
Not here. I don't think, although it's interesting, I think he has a separate baking facility.
Well, you know, it's not really why, you know, he'd be better off making all the bread in one place in the middle of Paris. You know, it's not like they're shipping it, you know,
it's
to Hawaii.
It's like right in Poilin, there's one...
Right.
There's one oven.
Well, they have actually, they actually did open up
a
facility outside of the city of Paris, and they have eight ovens, I believe, that are in a circle that replicate the way that they make the bread. So the bread you buy at the supermarket, Poilin, is very good.
Right. And we should say that Poilin is this legendary, famous Parisian bread bakery, and they also make sweets. They also make a phenomenal apple tart.
Yeah, the apple tart's really good.
But back in America... What was your first career plan after you started making chocolate soufflés?
I was always kind of drawn to things that were creative, and so I went to film school.
You did?
And I went to film school in New York, and after I graduated, my grandmother, who was very, you know, she grew up Depression era, you know.
Practical.
Practical. Well, heavily practical and very frugal, you know, that kind of thing. But she said to me, she goes, you should travel because you're never going to get another chance in your life to do it. And she goes, I really wish I had done that. So when I graduated from college, instead of going to a career, I took a year and I hitchhiked around Europe.
Wow.
And I could never do that now. I'd be like, can someone carry my backpack?
Like, you know,
or doesn't it have wheels or something? But, you know, I did that for a year and... I actually met a group of people. I was in Turkey, and then one of the people, a woman, was from San Francisco. I said, I always wanted to go to San Francisco.
And, how old were you?
Oh, 22.
Yeah.
Or something like that, maybe 23. And she goes, why don't you come visit? And I'd been working at a restaurant in college. It was a really good restaurant, actually. It was a vegetarian restaurant.
In New York?
Yes.
What was it called?
It was called Cabbage Town Cafe in upstate New York. And everything, most of the stuff we got was, we didn't have any machines in the kitchen except for a blender, but we bought all the stuff from the farmers because that was what people did back
then.
Way
ahead of your time. Now, what town was this in?
In Ithaca, New
York. In Ithaca, got it.
So, you know, we had Cornell dairy products and all that. And so I had that education behind me and I was, I was like, well, I guess I should work in a restaurant then. If I'm going to work in a restaurant, I may as well work in a really good restaurant.
So you get out to San Francisco. Come on.
And you want me to keep going? Okay. So I thought, well, if I'm going to work in a restaurant, I may as well work in the best restaurant I can work at. And it was the time when Chez Panisse, Zuni Cafe, 4th Street Grill, that whole thing was just starting to explode. And people don't realize now, they're very spoiled. They think, Whole Foods is terrible, Starbucks is terrible, but in the 80s, a dream would be to have something like Whole Foods, and you just couldn't imagine a supermarket being like that. And Chez Panisse, I was so attracted to the Chez Panisse menu cookbook.
Oh, it's funny. A lot of chef friends love that book. My friend Tom Douglas, who I wrote a cookbook with, who's the sort of seminal chef in Seattle, loves that menu cookbook.
Well, it was a great book. It was also a statement. And, cookbooks don't necessarily have to be just a collection of recipes. It's a statement. This is Chez Panisse. Here's what we do. And it was told through menus. And it was a lovely book, lovely story. I loved everything about it. And so I said, well, I'm going to go work at Chez Panisse. So I went into Chez Panisse.
Knocked.
Yeah, well, I went in and the chef looked at me and she told me to get out. She said, you just walk in here and I don't know who you are and you can't just walk. And so I left and I was dejected. So I went and worked somewhere else.
I think appropriately so. You should have been dejected.
Well,
you were rejected.
Yeah, but I was a good hire.
Right.
Like, I got my first restaurant job. The guy was a chef and he goes, you know how to move in the kitchen. You're hired. So anyhow, I went back 6 months later. I worked somewhere else and I had heard that there was a changeover in the command, and so of course I ran over there and I got hired, and I was so excited working as a line cook upstairs in the cafe.
Oh yeah!
And back in those days, the cafe was open from 5 p.m. to 11:30, and at 5 p.m. there was a line out the door and down the sidewalk because they didn't take reservations. It was on Chez Panisse. People were coming from all over the world, and people just. We were busy from the moment the doors opened till 11:30.
I love the cafe. I've actually never eaten at the downstairs at the fancier restaurant. The first time we went to the cafe, I ordered, it just said pluot, $7 for dessert. I was what are they doing to this pluot? Mm-hmm. Is it just a pluot? It can't possibly be worth $7. They brought out a pluot with a knife, and then I just took a slice of it, and I was like, God damn, that's the best pluot I've ever had in my whole life.
Yeah, I go back to Chez Panisse every once in a while, and I had a salad last time. It was a green salad, and it was so good. And you forget, if you don't eat that kind of food or if you don't have access to those kind of ingredients, like the salad, the lettuce is picked that afternoon.
Right.
And it sounds ethereal and it sounds effete, but it's actually delicious.
It's
really fresh, like this $7 pluot you had. So, that's something I really learned at Chez Panisse was the value of ingredients and how to make simple food taste good.
Right. And that's, of course, those have become cliches, but a lot of people don't understand is that whole ethos emanated from Chez Panisse.
Right. That didn't exist. You go to McDonald's or you get on the airplane and there's radicchio in your salad now. That was because of Chez Panisse.
Right.
When I started there, customers were like, is that cabbage? They thought the goat cheese, we had to get fresh goat cheese from Laura Chanel. They're like, oh, is this tofu? I'm like, no, it's goat cheese. And, how do you get why are the oranges red? It's like
they're blood
oranges.
The first goat cheese maker in Sonoma County, I believe, and she's sold fairly recently, I know.
Okay. Oh, did she? Okay.
To a big company.
Oh, there was a big company that buys a lot of small cheese.
Exactly. And I don't know if the same company, but like the people who own Ocean's Betty.
Cowgirl Creamery.
Yeah, they sold too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's to the same person. But you ended up staying for 13 years.
I know, you make it sound so final.
It's because the only place I've ever stayed 13 years out of Serious Eats.
Well, you didn't have a choice. You were the owner. Well, the problem with Chez Panisse, but the thing about Chez Panisse is when you work there, it's hard to go somewhere else because people don't have those standards. You know, you go work for somebody and they're like, oh, you know, we can't use that ingredient, it's too expensive. Like at Chez Panisse with Alice, nothing was too expensive. We were using organic butter. This is 25 years ago when it was $7 a pound. And she was committed to using this organic local butter that this company that was just starting out called Strauss Creamery. So we used all their dairy products.
Which now makes the best soft serve I've ever had.
Oh, they do?
Oh, my God.
Where can we get some? Where's the green room here?
We gotta take the plane to San Francisco, man. So you lasted 13 years, and mm-hmm. you eventually moved into pastry.
Right.
And worked for Lindsay Shearer, who a lot of people don't know about.
Right.
What an important figure she was, mm-hmm. not just in baking, but in American food in general.
Yeah. I'm getting chills. I'm actually going to cry.
No,
I get really emotional.
It's true. I think I've only met her once, mm-hmm. but I was so taken, you know, in reading your book and other books, like Lindsay Shearer, nobody mm-hmm. remembers her.
But she was from a different era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was sort of the Claudia Fleming era. You know, people in the baking business
of course.
Know who she is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she was always a behind-the-scenes person. She wasn't, you know, everyone thinks Alice Waters, Chez Panisse. They don't think about the other, there was, several other owners.
Right. And
Lindsay Shearer was one of the founders. And Lindsay really, you know, she didn't work shifts so much when I was there. You know, she had done that. But she was really, she'd come in with these beautiful fruits from like the countryside. She's like, oh, I got these, you know, I picked these wild grapes. Can you do something with them? Like, oh my God, you know, and everything was like beautiful and lovely. And she really set that tone. And she also taught me a lot about simplicity. Because I remember once saying to her, well, I really wish we did more fancy things because I'd like to learn more technique. And she said, well, why? Because that stuff doesn't taste very good.
Yeah, that's funny because I remember getting I called Nancy Silverton on her cell phone once and she said, oh, I'm at the Santa Monica Farmers Market and I just bought these incredible, I forgot what they were, strawberries or something, you know, gooseberries. Mm. And I said, what are you going to do with them? She said, I'm going to eat them,
oh.
and I'm going to serve them because I can't improve upon them. It is a uh-huh. sort of first cousin of that Pluot story.
Right. Although gooseberries are hard to eat
right.
raw, they're
but I think
tart.
They must have been strawberries.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I bought some strawberries at the market here in New York the other day, and they were so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the day-neutral strawberries have really changed the game
yeah.
here.
But people keep writing to me like, you know, they go, oh, I can't. Whenever I put anything about strawberries on my blog, you know, in France, I go, why can't we get strawberry? I'm like, you can get beautiful fruit here.
It's spectacular. Yeah, the day-neutral strawberries, which were developed, I think, by a food scientist at Cornell, mm-hmm. means that the strawberry season here is very long because day neutral means they don't need the same amount of sunlight.
Okay.
You can get good ones now.
Okay. And they last long. Like,
yeah.
They don't rot like after 2 days.
Yeah. So, you know, think about it. If it's day neutral, it doesn't matter. As the mm-hmm. more sunlight, you're still going to have them. And then even uh-huh. when the sunlight starts to fade, you're going to have them.
I'm actually going to cop that phrase someday, day neutral.
Yeah, you can. You don't have okay. to. You don't even have to attribute it to me.
Okay. Is that your
No, it wasn't mine. So how long did you work there before you became head pastry chef?
Well, I was never the head pastry chef.
You were.
Lindsay Shearer was the head pastry chef.
Got it.
She was the owner, and that was her role. And there was like four of us that worked together. Or maybe five.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been seven, but there was four or five of us.
Yeah.
So we all worked together. We didn't really have a hierarchy. When I was there until, you know, Lindsay started, she opened a bakery in Healdsburg,
yes.
California, and she was a less active role.
Was that Model Bakery? Or?
No, it was called the Downtown Bakery.
That's right. Yeah.
And she opened that with Kathleen Stewart, who was a waitress in the downstairs restaurant. And Kathleen Stewart, who's wonderful, one day, somebody, I don't know how somebody found this out, but she was one of Dean Martin's Golden Girls. And somebody found a picture somewhere and printed it out and put it on the kitchen wall. And she came in and she looked at us and she used an expletive.
You can use it. It's just a podcast.
No, I don't like to swear in public because people think I'm like a nice person.
Right.
But she's like, F you guys. Because we were all just on the floor.
That's hilarious. So what's the best piece of advice you ever got from Lindsay Scheer about baking? Pastry or cooking.
Gosh. I don't know if it's any piece of advice, but it was just keeping it simple. Like, once again, letting the ingredients shine. And sometimes I feel like I'm not keeping up my end of the bargain in the pastry world because I don't do all this fancy stuff. I was recently on a TV show, and it was one of those competition shows. And I was like, oh, someone's going to make something really fancy, and I'm going to make, like, lemon tart. You know, and I was kind of, you know what? Like, I would rather have a really good lemon tart.
Me too. And what's the one piece of advice you offer aspiring pastry chefs?
Well, nowadays, I tell people actually to leave cities, like people who are in like New York or San Francisco. I'm like, go somewhere else because it's so expensive to live in these places. And now in America, there's so many great food cities.
There's great food cultures all over the country. Yeah. You can go to Portland, Maine, Portland, Oregon, Denver, Colorado.
Des Moines. Yeah, I mean, there's just really good food everywhere now. And that's really lovely. And you don't need to be in New York or San Francisco.
Do you have pastry heroes?
I do.
And what do you admire about each of them?
You know, there are people like Alice Medrich, Flo Breaker, who passed away last year.
Alice Medrich had a shop in Berkeley called
Cocolat,
and has written many great
She introduced
books.
What was, you know, the French truffle to America. She called it the American truffle because they were sort of the size of small golf balls, if that makes sense. And I used to go there before my pastry shift and have dessert because it was flourless chocolate. Like, no one knew what a flourless chocolate cake was.
Wow.
And she was doing all this stuff, and we became friends, you know, later in life, more. And I was always like, I'm still am in awe whenever I see her. I'm like, and Nancy Silverton is sort of somebody who I just...
The greatest.
And I remember her when she was just at the pastry chef at Spago with her hair pulled up on the top of her head. And she's been able to persevere and change, and she changed the culture of baking in Los Angeles and in America.
I agree. So how did you go from being a line cook to being in the pastry department?
Well, I kept going down to the pastry department and watching the people and talking, and they were like cutting up fruit and making tarts, and I was like, "Oh, I want to do that." I'd rather than making steaks or opening oysters upstairs and in the cafe. And finally an opening opened up. And because I've been writing too much, I go, I can't use the same word in one sentence. An opening opened up, you know, my editor will like cross that out, or some reader will tell me, you can use that word already. So anybody who's listening to the podcast, you can send Ed an email at about my overuse of the word. But anyhow, a position opened up and it was between me and somebody else. And once again, I'm not competitive. And then I actually somehow got the job. And I became the pastry person.
That's
I worked
great.
At night, and it was tough, you know, very hard work. We worked really hard. And whenever people ask me nowadays if I'm speaking at an event or a conference, you know, people will go, what do you attribute your success to? And I'm like, I work really hard.
Right.
And, you know,
it's like, that's the kind of the not so deep and dark secret about everyone's success.
Yeah. Well, you know, Madonna, Jacques.
And sometimes it's not enough.
Yeah, nobody just arrives. I mean, restaurant work is really hard work.
Yeah.
That's why nobody over 40 does it.
It's true. So what did you do when you finally left, and why did you leave?
I left because I was getting older, and when your body hits a certain age, you just say, it's hard to stand up for 8.5 hours. It's like, I need to listen to my body. I need to, like, go to the bathroom when I have to go to the bathroom without someone knocking on the door asking, like, where the desserts are. Or I need to eat. You know, I need to sit down. I want to sit down and have a meal. I don't want to, shove food in my mouth. So I was kind of burnt out. And I had had all these dessert recipes in my repertoire. And I had spoken to Alice Waters. I said, well, you know, also we had a lot of – Lindsay Scheer wrote the first Chez Panisse dessert book. And I said, well, maybe I should write the second one. Would that be interesting? And she said, write your own. which is actually.
But she said it in a very nice way.
Well, I remember it being nice, but maybe not. No, she said, Alice is wonderful. But she said to me, you know, you're different than we are. You have a different style and you should do your own thing. And I think I looked at her and I said, well, will you write the introduction to a book if I do it? It's
like, right.
And she goes, yes.
That's Kenji's writing the introduction to the Serious Eats book that I'm writing.
Okay.
So it's, you know.
Well, he wrote the intro to Stella's book.
Yes.
Too, so.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that was good advice. And she's seen people come and seen people go. And the Chez Panisse is a huge family. And, you know, it was time for me to go. It was time for me to do something else. And so I wrote, you know, a couple of books, and it was very interesting because I'd never written a cookbook before.
Yeah, so the year you left, you published the first book, which has the longest subtitle in book history.
Oh, really?
Because it's called Room for Dessert, 110 Recipes for Cakes, Custards, Soufflés, Tarts, Pies, Cobblers, Sherbets, Ice Creams, Cookies, Candies, Cordials, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
And that was the days before keywords on the internet. So, well, I guess it makes up for my last book, My Paris Kitchen. The subtitle was Recipes and Stories.
You began blogging in 1999. Mm-hmm. People call me one of the OG food bloggers, but yeah. You were blogging about food 6 years before I even knew what a blog was.
I'm just going to tell you this once, and I want you never to forget this, but you exist because of me. Interview over. He's kicking me out the door.
but I mean,
he's like,
why did you start blogging? What were you blogging about? How did you do it? There wasn't even any blogging software then.
Well, I had thought, you know, I'm writing my first book. My first book's coming out, and I should use this internet thing. And if people have problems with recipes, they can contact me. Because often you make something from a book and you think, oh, well, this recipe, I don't understand what the author means or something. I thought, you know, this is in the be careful what you wish for category of the show. I thought, oh, I'll have a web, you know, do a website and I'll share things. I'll share recipes and stories. And I had a forum on my site, you know, which was
right. That's always scary. Forums in the
back
old
in those
school.
Days, like nobody was on the internet so much. It wasn't, you know, the word trolls didn't, you know, there wasn't.
Right.
It was all my friends leaving stuff just to fill space on my blog.
And you were writing your own code, rudimentary as it must have been, but still, like when I started Ed Levine Eats, which was the precursor to Serious Eats, I used Blogger.
Blogger didn't exist in those days.
The word blog didn't really exist except to super techie freak nerds.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember I was updating my site. You know, for a while I had somebody doing it for me because I didn't know how to publish a web page. So I would write things and send them to him. And then there was a new, you know, blogging software came out. It was something called Movable Type.
Yes,
you remember that?
Serious Eats was on Movable Type.
And I remember, you know, I was from San Francisco.
We just moved. We just migrated last year, David.
Well, I know some big sites had just migrated because everything had been hacked.
Right. Yeah,
and it was such a challenge. One thing I learned, you had Elise Bauer on as your guest a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I love Elise. If she's listening, I love her more than anything. She always says something really good. She's like, do something sooner than later. Because it's not going to get any easier.
It's true.
And
it's
I switched to WordPress when, you know, it was a challenge. I had a lot of stuff, and the guy who designed my site designed Simply Recipes, the site. And he had a lot of work ahead of him, and it was very expensive. But he was, once again, he was the best at what he did. He did a great job.
Right.
And now my site is, you know, he had to move a lot of the stuff, which is not fun.
Yeah. So 1999, you start blogging. Mm-hmm. I assume you're not making any money from the blog.
Well, no,
there's no way to monetize in those
days. No, there was nothing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you were making your money from your book advances pretty much, right? Or were you still doing some kitchen work?
No, I was out of the kitchen. I was writing books. And, you know, books are not like not a very lucrative thing.
No, it's not.
So I moved from San Francisco to a little tiny apartment in Paris.
Right. So in 2000,
I was like, how can I save money? I need to move to Paris.
You moved to Paris And you also published The Great Book of Chocolate that year. Mm-hmm. What were the circumstances of your departure from the States?
Well, that's probably another book, which I'm not going to write. But I didn't really have anything to do in America. I'd been living in San Francisco for a long time. I didn't have a job. I was writing books, but that was it. And I was like, well, you know, I can write anywhere. So.
And you wrote about your, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but you wrote about your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And you lost your partner.
Right.
And so was that also added impetus to needing to start a new life somewhere else?
Not necessarily, but once again, it gave me the moment to say, you know what? I don't have anything here left. Like, I pretty much lost everything.
Mm.
And it was like, oh, okay. What do I do now? And I had a couple of very difficult years, and I didn't know what to do with my life. And people always say to me, well, didn't you move to Paris because you were a Francophile and you wanted to? And I was like, no. But I realized, you know, I just realized this recently, that the reason I moved to France was because it was sort of a horizontal move. It was very similar to Northern California, the climate. I was very into food. You know, the food was the similar, goat cheese, you know, garlic, wine. And it seemed like a horizontal move to go to Paris. So mm-hmm.
So you just packed up and left. Did you know anyone in Paris?
No, I didn't know. I knew David Tanis.
Oh, David Tanis, yeah. who was on Special Sauce, yeah. And is now cooking at the Monkey Bar for
some
reason.
Well, I think I don't know if he's cooking there, but he's running, he's organizing
something.
It.
Yeah.
But he was living in Paris, and I knew him because he was the chef at Chez Panisse.
Got it.
So he was pretty the only person I knew.
Wow, so like, the plane lands in Paris. You talk about in one of your books, they lost all your cookbooks.
Well, those were shipped. I mean,
So what did you do? Like, did you stay at David's? Like, where did you stay?
Well, I had my three suitcases. This is, I think, three. This is the old days when you could have three suitcases, and they were pretty full. And I arrived in this apartment that, you know, the door opened, and I found the apartment on the internet, and it looked kind of nothing like the apartment, you know.
That. I'm shocked. That never happens.
Well, I'll say Airbnb. I mean, it was...
As you say in your book, Lepart, the joy of wide-angle lenses.
Yeah. Well, now, what people shoot. But, you know, it was just, this is like 2002. In those days, someone had a point-and-shoot camera, and they took a picture of the apartment, but the person wasn't living there, and the ceiling was collapsing and everything. So I was like, oh, okay, you know. And so much stuff had happened to me in my life, like those 3 to 5 years before, that I was like, you know what? I kind of experienced the worst thing that can happen to anybody. Mm. So I'm just going to go with this.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, here I'm living in this country now with all my stuff. I don't speak French. I don't know anyone.
Good move there, David. Don't speak French. Yeah. That's the key.
I know people write to me, they're like, I want to move to Paris, but I don't speak French. I'm like, well, people do it, you know.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks, David, for sharing your journey with us.
Thanks, Ed.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.